Okay, good morning, good morning. We're in Ecclesiastes, and we've already done three chapters. And all of this is on the final exam. The final exam is oral. A one-on-one with the head teacher, which is going to be... And he's very lenient, but he'll want you to get the essentials. And then you get to meet King Solomon, and he'll say, "Did you read my book?" And it'll be very awkward if you say, "Who are you?" And "No, what book did you write?" So you at least want to know a little bit. Ecclesiastes is the book. It is attributed to King Solomon, who calls himself the Kohelet, which in some Bibles is translated preacher, but that's not the right meaning in Hebrew. The meaning in Hebrew is searcher, or the inquirer, or the investigative recorder, the person who is making a systematic study of life to see what the meaning of things is. And this is Solomon, the richest man in the ancient world, extremely wealthy. He threw lavish banquets for 10,000 people. He was also the wisest man in the ancient world. He had so much wisdom that people would come from near and far to ask him difficult questions and to seek his wisdom and counsel. And when he first became king, and he was king for 40 years, when he first became king, he was very close to the Lord, and that shows up in the Song of Solomon, for instance, which he wrote. But he married 700 wives, and many of them brought their foreign gods into Jerusalem and led him away from devotion to the Lord. So he had a good long period of his life in which he was, we would say backsliding. Or he was not going to church, only there wasn't any church. He was not paying any attention to God, but he set out to do an investigation of the meaning of life, systematically, to look into absolutely everything he could think of. He could afford it, he had time, he had servants, he had a great mind, and he was interested in a whole lot of things, so he went about to find the meaning of life. And so far, what he finds, as we've seen, is everything that he looks into proves to be empty, or proves to have no net worth, or no to be without any purpose in and of itself. There are a lot of things that are worthwhile doing, but they don't lead anywhere in the end. Life is meaningless, or vanity. He uses the word vanity, which means empty. However, that's just the surface, because in chapter 3 we discovered there's a little secret to the Song of Solomon. The secret is that life is meaningless as long as you have excluded God from what you're doing. When you shut God out of your life, nothing that you do will have any net long-term benefit. Life is meaningless without God, no matter what you do. If, however, you decide to include God in what you're doing, then everything is meaningful, and that turns the thing the whole equation totally upside down. The other thing that comes out in here is that most people in life are looking for meaning or happiness. What is the road to happiness? What is the American dream? What is my path to contentment? And Solomon says that God is the one who makes people contented. He alone gives you a sense of fulfillment, of pleasure, of enjoyment, and that if God doesn't give it to you, you won't get it any other way. It isn't to be found. And God is delighted to give you enjoyment and pleasure and fulfillment in life as long as you have given him permission to be in your life. So that turns everything upside down too, because it says that if you include Jesus in your life, it doesn't matter what you're doing, work, career, family, friends, whatever you do will be meaningful, and God's able to give you enjoyment and meaning no matter how ordinary or mundane your tasks are. There's no one right job. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor. It doesn't matter whether you're in school or in jail or whatever. God's able to impart meaning to your life, and he will do that as a gift. Now then, that's embarrassing when you look at all the people around us that are frantically trying to find happiness in life, but God's the last thing in the world they will consider. So that's the key. So this is a very interesting little book about the keys to meaning and purpose in life, which come from knowing God in every area of life. So God, we can't put God in one little compartment and have God only for Sunday. The idea would be to have Jesus part of everything you do. Now, obviously, that there's, if you decided you wanted to be a drug dealer and a serial killer and a rapist and a child molester, those would not be good career choices to live in harmony with God, obviously that. So obviously, if you're going to live in harmony with God, obviously you choose a lifestyle that pleases God. That goes without saying. But anyway, Solomon's very objective. Last time in chapter 3, there were some things that we kind of highlighted. There's this famous passage, there is a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born, time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, time to heal, time to break down, time to build up, time to weep, a time to laugh, time to mourn, a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, time to gather stones, time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain, a time to hide, time to keep, time to throw away, a time to tear, a time to sow, a time to keep silence, a time to speak, a time to love, a time to hate, a time for war, a time for peace. There's a song, I forget, what's that popular song about that?
Turn, turn, turn.
It puts that all to word. That life has seasons and cycles in it which are unavoidable. You're going to have a death in the family, it's a time to mourn. It was unexpected. You were tooling along with something else on your mind and your grandmother died. Well, you stop everything you do and it becomes a time when you are mourning. The time for building up is when you're young and growing and you're starting your career and your family and you're building a home and family. That's the season in life in which you focus on building. When you get older is the time to sort of shut down and consolidate. There's time for merriment and good fun. There's a time for sadness. There's a time when you don't say anything. And there's another time when you speak out. All these things go with life. And everybody faces them and they're unavoidable. And so that's just part of the way the world is. It has these seasons in it. And that we don't have a lot to control about it, to say about those. You don't plan some of these things. But be prepared, life's going to throw these cycles at you, which is just part of the way things are. All right? Please ask questions. This is a review a little bit. We get down to verse, we did chapter 3. I put these, recording these on my iPod and I take them home, put them on my website in MP3 if you want to go listen to them on my website under audio.html. Because I'm going fast and there's a lot here. And I would, if you want to interrupt and ask questions and make comments, please do. There was a wonderful little, but mostly by chapter 3, Solomon is looking into the way the world really is, the things that people go through. You have to work in order to eat. You have to get along with people. You have to deal with things. Everybody does, totally apart from whether you know God or not. For example, we've already seen that work is something that's part of life for everybody. Everybody's got to work in one way or another. In verse 9 of chapter 3, he says, "What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time, or everything appropriate in its time, but he has also put the longing of eternity in men's hearts, so that no one can find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. It's a good thing to work and to enjoy your work, even if it's mundane and even if it's exhausting and tiring. It's part of what God gives it to everybody." Well, he sort of asks the question, where is this taking you? What are you going to end up with when you have you have all the money that you ever wanted? What's that going to get you? Is that going to get you what you want? course, the answer to that, we've already found out he doesn't. But he said, there's an appropriateness to everything, verse 13. And then there's this little secret, little insight in verse 11, pardon me, chapter 3, verse 11. God has put eternity, or the longing for eternity, in men's hearts. No matter what you do, there is this God-shaped vacuum in people. There is this longing for something better. Isn't there more to life? Shouldn't there be meaning behind things? What is all this about? There is this longing for heaven planted in everybody's hearts. No matter how fulfilled and happy you are in this life, it's never enough. There's always this, the fulfillment. You never have enough time to enjoy your friends. You never have enough contentment. You never have enough peace of mind to last forever. So that's a healthy thing, because it forces us to search after God, because only in God are we going to find the missing elements of life. I know, he says, I know in verse 12, I know that there is nothing better for man than men and women than to rejoice and do good in their lives, and that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God, that God would like to have everybody enjoy their work, even if it's digging a ditch in the hot sun, even if it's scrubbing the floor, even if it's something mundane. God would like people to be able to enjoy just the very task of working. It's just, don't consider it a dreary thing. Find something, you know, sing or pray or stop and realize that you're going to be exhausted in another hour, but then you can go home. And God would like to have people enjoy work, and work's a necessary part of life, so there's no reason to balk at that. Like little kids do, you know. When mommy says, pick up your clothes, make your bed. It's, I don't want to. Somebody else can do it. My brother doesn't make his bed. Verse 14, I know that whatever God does will last forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. That is, God has put certain limits in life. He's decided how many years you get to live. He gave you the parents. He's arranged the circumstances of your life. He gave you gifts and strengths and limits, and he's overall sovereign in life, and no matter what you do, you can't go beyond the limits in life that God has put there. He wants us to realize that. And the whole purpose of this is that eventually, if you want to run your own life, you're going to come crashing into the fact that God's behind the scenes and he's bigger than you are and he's smarter and he's in charge. And inevitably, God is behind the scenes. And so it's futile and dangerous for you to think you can outwit and outsmart God, because he's set boundaries and limits. And then he says, Solomon says, I have discovered that God requires an accounting from everybody for everything. That is, God's keeping minute records in his Apple laptop, an iBook, and with his recording angels, and he keeps detailed records on everybody doing whatever, everything, but and those records are there, and one day or another, every human being has to explain himself to God. Now, if you're forgiven and if you're one of God's children, this is not a terrible cross-examination. This is a rewards event. It's not punishment. But there is accountability in life. What goes around comes around. Nobody gets away with anything in the long run. But then he goes on. There's quite a little bit in here about the fact that when you look at the real world, there's a lack of justice on all sides. We very seldom see criminals really caught and punished in proportion to the number that get away. Things that are hurts and wrongs that people do to one another are seldom fixed. There's a lot of corruption in the courts. And that's because God takes his time and doesn't judge things immediately. God takes long delayed in his judgments, and so people think he never judges. You get the idea that God doesn't care, or that he's uninvolved, or what's happened to me is terribly unfair, and you cry out to God for help, and he does nothing. And that's because God waits a long time before he judges, but But you can be sure that when he gets around to judging, he won't overlook a single detail. This is, of course, what the New Testament says. When you've got something, a grievance, leave it to God to repay it. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. Because the Lord will fix things far better than you could. If you try to right the wrongs that people have done to you, you'll mess it up worse. And you won't judge and act righteously the way God was. So if you can leave things in the hand of God, eventually he'll straighten them out perfectly. That means that he punishes wrongdoing and he rewards people who are quietly doing good. And then he'll heal people who've been hurt by being taken advantage of or exploited or whatever. All those things are all part of the justice of God. Then he goes on in chapter 3 to talk about everybody's going to die. So that life has this great leveling thing. It doesn't matter whether you're rich or famous or well-known or obscure. You've only got 70, 80, 90 years to live, and then you're going to be dead too. And that's the great leveling ground in life. And so obviously if there's any ultimate meaning to your life, it's going to be in what God remembers about you. Otherwise, you'll just be soon forgotten. You may think that you were important, but your memory will quickly go away. Everybody returns to the dust. Now, in verse 22, at the end of chapter 3, he says, I perceive that there's nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, that is his heritage. Who can bring him to see what will happen after him? Take pleasure in your life today. You don't know what tomorrow contains. You don't know whether we have a big earthquake or 10 feet of snow will come down on us this afternoon, or there'll be an economic collapse or a sudden opportunity to go someplace. All those things are out of our control. Neither do we know what life's going to be like after we're gone. All the things that you built, maybe you built a great company. And you started this great company that's world-renowned. You have no idea that 10 years after you're dead, whether that company will flourish or whether it'll fold or whether the next managers will come in and run it right. You worked hard for it, but you have no control over the long-term future of it. So, if life is like this, and it has this unpredictability in it, then get as much out of every day as you can. That would be almost existential. Live, enjoy the things that are there for you to do today, and let every one of them be meaningful. Yeah?
I always bring this up on here. How can you enjoy life when you have absolutely, you're broke, you're poor, you have no money? How can you enjoy life? How can you enjoy
life?
That's
a great question. Okay, that's great.
If you have no money to eat, you have no money to buy clothes, you have no money to go out or enjoy something or go see a movie, you can't enjoy life to the fullest.
Well, we have one example in history of somebody that was like that. Jesus had no money. Mm-hmm. He had one set of clothes, didn't have a donkey, didn't have a house, didn't own any property. Was contented to do the will of the Father all the time, and his life was full of joy joy and delight of serving people. So the answer here again is, God gives joy to you as a gift, and so he's able to give you joy in your poverty. If you're locked up in prison and you're chained to the wall, he can give you joy, contentment in prayer, contentment in fellowship with him. Poor people are generally appreciate God more because they need God more. Will God somehow send you in enough to eat today? Will he keep you warm tonight in the cold under the bridge? Will he look after you? Will God take great care of the poor? Rich people are very miserable, as we've already seen generally. So I think in our culture you think, I don't deserve to be poor. I deserve to have good things in life. But once again, the hidden secret is Jesus is delighted to make you content with your circumstances and to bless you and to make you a blessing to other people no matter what. And he can use you. You may be in the position not to give money, but in the position to just be a friend to somebody, or an encouragement, or a prayer. I know a really great guy who's bipolar and on lithium and mentally not very well, who's got an incredible prayer life. He prays hours and hours and hours for people, and you can tell it the moment you see him that his whole life is in prayer, that is full, it's just saturated with prayer, and he's all day long praying for people. Well, he hasn't got much going for him in the world of relationships with people because he's been through so much trauma. But boy, is he ever a giant with God. And his great calling would be to pray. So I asked him to please put me on his list, say. So one of the problems we have is that we want to look at the world the way secular people look at the world, rather than the way that God's looking at it. And that's what Solomon's finding out here. Now, Solomon's the richest man in the world, and he is miserable in his riches, and he was the first to tell us that his money came to mean nothing to him. And that would be what the New Testament says: God had chosen the poor in this world to be rich in faith, and heirs of the kingdom to those that he has promised to those who love him. That God singles out the poor people to bless them, and the poor people of the world ordinarily are richer in faith, and usually the poor inherit the kingdom of God, and usually the rich are lost, stay lost. And if you're poor for 60 or 70 years, and after that you're a very wealthy king in heaven, was it worth waiting for? Yeah, it was worth waiting for. Okay? Chapter 4. Then I returned, and I considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed. They have no comforter on this, on the side. They have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there was power, but they had no comforter. He looks out at all the homeless people in San Jose, and they are running around with a plastic bag with all their belongings, and it's very cold in the winter under the bridge, and these are women and children sometimes, and there aren't any homeless shelters, and there's no relief, and they've been taken advantage of. Maybe these people are widows that have living on Social Security, and some con artist has come along and conned them out of all their income and ripped off their property just because they were gullible. And who comes to their aid? Is the world full of that sort of stuff? Sure is. Are there a lot of bad guys that take advantage of the poor and the disabled and the old and the infirm? Yep. Widows, yes. Wonderful scam artists that love to rip off widows and get all their money. And is that wrong? Is it terribly wrong? Is there some government agency that steps in and catches all this? Well, no. In general, there isn't. That's what he says. The poor and the exploited and the weak and the widows are preyed upon, and they have no defender. Nobody comes to their aid. It appears to be that way. And when Solomon saw that, and he realized how much misery there was around him, he said, "Therefore I praise the dead who are already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil of the work that is done under the sun." People are better off dead than being oppressed and being taken advantage of and being living miserable lives. It would be better that they were dead. It would be better if human beings had never existed in the first place, if they're going to come in and live a miserable life in this awful old world. Because the world is full of a great deal of evil and suffering. Does anybody else that you can think of in the Bible that says, "I wish I had never been born"?
Job
said that. Yeah, Job said that. Job, in his misery and his ashes, when God had reduced him down to just absolute nothing, said, "Oh, it was a terrible day when my brother brought me into this world. I wish I'd never been born." And I think everybody feels that sometimes. And there are certainly people who go through their whole lives miserably. And so from outward appearances. So this Solomon's simply making an observation that this is an evil world, it's a fallen world, there's a lot of wrong, there's a lot of man's inhumanity to man, a lot of people suffer, a lot of people are oppressed. He doesn't tell you, doesn't have a fix for it at this point. He just says, this is the way it is. Again, verse 4, "Again I saw that for all toil and for every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping after wind." Since I've been studying human behavior, and one thing I notice, what motivates people to get a job and earn more money and to climb the ladder of success? What is it that motivates people to get the nicer house in the hills and the new car and the new clothes? Why do people do that?
To gain more money. To gain more money.
Why do people strive after more, and why are people not content with, say, a modest life?
Envy.
Can you imagine that? Then how much of the world is driven by envy? Your neighbor, you've got to have a car as new as your neighbor's car, and you've got to have a house as nice as theirs. And how much envy drives all of the social climbing that people do? How few people are that have, say, a modest income, actually sit back and enjoy their modest income and their simple but very comfortable home? Not very many. And so isn't this stupid that you spend your whole life striving to get what your neighbor has, and when you get what your neighbor has, are you going to be happy with that? No. You're going to turn right around and find that your neighbor has gotten himself a newer car still. And if you're driving around some old rice burner clunker car, you don't want your friends to see that you have got such an old wreck of a car that gets good mileage and is very economical and will last forever. Now that's Solomon looking at the vanity that drives society. This lack of contentment, this longing for more, this craving to have more of something, it's covetousness is what it is. And it's envy. And it's based on, I'm not as good as you are, but once I get what you've got, I will be at least as good as you are, maybe even better. If I work hard, I'll be better than you are. All that foolish competition. And then you don't really like who you are the way God made you. You always want to be like somebody else that you think has got life better. You see that? That's pretty insightful. "The fool folds his hands and consumes his own flesh. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind." Now he says, there's some hippies out there. I've seen some street people that don't seem to give a darn about climbing the social ladder, and they've got one set of dirty clothes, and they like to smoke pot in the park, and what little money they have, they quickly spend, and they have it, but they certainly are enjoying life. Pretty much. Street people are hitchhiking around and staying at wherever they can and not taking things seriously. But they've dropped out of the rat race. Okay? So Solomon says, I see these people consuming their own flesh. That is, they're not working hard to get anywhere in life. They're using up what resources they've got. But he says, better is a handful, better is a very little bit, if with contentment, with quietness, then both hands full, grasping, toiling, working, striving after the wind. So he says it's far better to be a dropout, living a good life, living a life of quiet contentment and happiness, than it is to be on this rat race where all of your time and energy is consumed in trying to get ahead. See that? He's not saying that it's good to be a hippie. He just says, or a dropout. He says, better. That person knows more about the quality of life than the guy that's constantly striving to get ahead. That got that?
But doesn't it seem like it's more of kind of this balance where it's not like you drop out of life because by doing that you're kind of consuming yourself?
Yeah. And if you drop, but the trouble with dropping out of life is you still have to eat.
Yeah.
And and work is still part of life and nobody's going to feed you. So you are, this can't run, this can't go on forever.
By pursuing after, like, you know, having it all two handfuls, like, you end up kind of torturing yourself. You're, like,
yeah.
Kind of spending yourself.
And then so this is a contrast. The other person is the one who's handfuls, is grasping the wind in handfuls, which amounts to the wind, who's all day long is obsessed with getting more, with success, and never kicks back and just enjoys friends. You know people like that. They're very driven people. They're not very fun to talk to. You can't sit down and have a relaxed conversation with them because they're constantly on their mind. They're always scheming about their projects. So there's just a contrast here. Then I returned and I saw vanity under the sun. There is one alone... He says there's one alone without a companion. He sees this man. This man has no companion. He has no wife. He has no son, no brother. Yet there's no end to his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. He never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. He notices that there are single, lonely people in the world who don't have any friends and don't have anybody close to them who work very, very hard to make something out of their lives, and they're never satisfied when they get there, and they always want more. And where is this going to end up? Where are they going to end up? This person never asks himself, what is the question this kind of a driven, lonely person says? And never bothers to inquire?
Why am I doing this?
Why am I doing this? Where is this taking me? See, he never says, hey, I haven't got any friends. Hey, I'm lonely. Man, I would love to walk down the beach and talk to somebody. I'd love to just go have dinner with a couple and kick back. He never asked those questions. So at the end of his life, he's an old miser, lonely old miser. That's stupid, isn't it? It's tragic. Isn't that tragic? Do you know people like that? Well, yeah, sure you do. Men and women alike that are lonely, don't have any friends, and still driven. Well, what are they driven for, and who do they have to leave their property? Suppose they work hard and get a lot of money. Who do they leave it to? Do they leave it to anybody that loves them, that appreciates it, that is grateful for it? Well, no, because they haven't got anybody in their life that loves them. So, you know, that's kind of sad. It doesn't make a good epitaph on the tombstone. What do you put on the tombstone?
He can make his own ahead of time before he dies.
He can make it and say what he was.
Yeah.
So he's life is, there's a tragic sense of life that Solomon is looking at. The tragic sense of life, when you back off a little bit, when you get out of the routine that you're in, and you step back a little bit and look at other people and look at yourself, and why are you doing what are you doing, and what is the quality of my life, and what am I living for? When you stop, then you see a lot of people are living really lives that are empty. Now here's some interesting little advice in verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. Is that true? Sure is. A business partnership, you got two guys working in the business, you get 10 times more done. Get a good wife, good husband, a good marriage partner, and you get along really well, and you're friends, and you work together. Is that valuable? Darn right it is. Two are better than one. They have a good reward for their labor. If one falls, the other will lift up his companion. Go for a hike in the hills, or mountain climbing up in the dangerous country, you ought to have at least one friend along. Well, no. If you fall off the edge of the trail, you got somebody that'll rescue you. If they fall, one will lift up his companion. Woe to the one who is alone when he falls. He has no one to help him up. That's absolutely true of mountaineering and rock climbing and going, who is this? You remember the story of the kid that went hiking all by himself out in the Utah desert and a boulder fell over on his arm? And he was all alone and couldn't get out and there was no help. And he finally cut his arm off with his knife, and just as he was already hypothermic, he was already pretty near death, and not only that did he cut his arm off and put a tourniquet on, but he walked out a zillion miles until he accidentally found help. Well, that's just incredible. Now, if he had one friend there with him, which the sensible thing to do is always take at least one friend along. This wouldn't have happened. Well, he's lucky to be alive. It's an incredible story. Well, there's all kinds of people that are like that, that go, but this is about anything in life. You're better if you got one friend. You're having a real bad day. Everything has gone wrong. What's the best thing you can do? Go cry on the shoulders of your friend. Go talk to your mom or your dad or brother or sister or somebody, your roommate, and just say, boy, have I had a bad day today. I don't know what to do. Woe to the one who is alone when he falls and when he has two to help him. Again, if two lie down together, they'll keep warm. How can one be warm alone? That's kind of, you know, you get these stories of people who go on Arctic expeditions and the wind blows and you're in this little pup tent and you're freezing to death, and the best thing to do is to get two people in the sleeping bag together. I have an old geologist friend who died a few years ago. He was one-legged, but he had an artificial leg. He decided on a summer afternoon to climb Mount Whitney, because at the top of Mount Whitney there's a cabin where you can stay overnight and find shelter. So he thought, just took it leisurely. He didn't have any warm clothes or any sleeping bag with him. So he climbed up to Mount Whitney, and he got to Mount Whitney in the late afternoon. And sure enough, the cabin was there, but the roof had fallen down because of snow last winter, and it was all full of snow. So there wasn't a mountain cabin there, and it was dark, and he could never find his way back down the trail at night. And it was the wind was blowing, and it was cold, and he didn't have any sleeping bag or any jacket. So here he is. He's done the stupidest thing, just enjoying the geology. And he walked around the back of the cabin, and here was this guy, this mountaineering man up there, all by himself in his sleeping bag. And there was only one choice. The one choice was, look, you've got to share my sleeping bag with me tonight. And so the two of them squeezed into this sleeping bag and got through the night nice and cozy and warm, and both lived. And my friend, it was very humorous afterwards. I guess they became good friends, because it was always a great story to tell about how the man with the sleeping bag had saved the life of the one-legged geologist. And it's a true story. Well, that's just... Look at what Solomon is saying, though. He's saying, if you're cold, it's nice to have somebody to snuggle up next to. That's kind of... boyfriend, girlfriend. Little kids like to go crawl in bed with mom and dad when they're scared. That's all just wonderful human affection. The one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. If you're walking down the street at night and there's a possibility you're getting mugged, you're far safer if two of you are walking down the street. You're not likely to get mugged if there are two of you walking down the street. If somebody attacks you, you've got a friend there, right, to defend you. That's true in life all the time. So it's true physically and it's true verbally. Somebody says something bad about you, something derogatory about you, something gossipy about you. Well, who's the best person to fix it for you? Your friend comes along and say, no, I've known Bill for 20 years and he's honest and honorable and he'd never lie or steal or cheat, and you're maligning him, and that what you said isn't true. So you see the value of friendships here. The value of friendships and companions and people that you trust and a good spouse in your marriage and good friends. This is a very important part of life. Then he says a threefold cord is not easily broken. If two is better than one, three is even better still. What happens when you get a group of three close friends? Three tight friends? That's fun. Now you have a really good time when you go to the beach. And you get into little squabbles and quarrels and disagreements, but how lively it gets to be, how useful is the conversation. You want to have a meeting of some kind, and you want to discuss something that's complicated, and you get three points of view. Is that helpful? It sure is. Does it help you pass your blind spots? Yeah, it does. So this is just kind of sort of common sense about life. Verse 13. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. You get a ruler, a dictator that's been a king for years, and he's old and cranky and opinionated, and he's not going to take advice from anybody, and he is doing a lousy job of being king. Solomon says, it would be better that we replace that old crotchety old king with some inexperienced young guy. Better is a poor but wise youth. Be better to put a young man, lacking in experience but fairly wise, in to replace that hard-hearted, foolish old king who won't take advice. See, he's talking, now we're talking about government, about leadership, about all the paradoxes of when you get a good king or a bad king, and that sort of thing. He who comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. So he's saying, here's a poor and wise youth who's actually been let out of prison and was born poor, and you could put him in to replace this old, cranky, incompetent old man and have a better king. In spite of him being poor and having been in jail and being young and being inexperienced. Might make a better king. See, there's a paradox there. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. Now suppose you take this, you get rid of this old king and you put in this young king. How's that story, the young guy that's out of jail and poor but fairly smart? How's his life going to work out, do you suppose?
He knows the aspects of how poverty is in the kingdom, and then he can use that tremendously to help out those who are...
There's the potentials there. How is the story likely to play out? What happens to many people who have potential for leadership? They're not experienced. They really look promising. You think they're going to do a much, much better job than the old king that they just got rid of, and everybody's all excited about this new guy. How do you suppose his life will usually play out?
Well, he might get comfortable and then just not do anything.
Yeah, he might end up being a real loser and a jerk, and he might be, and probably in his old age, he'll be as bad as the king they got rid of. Isn't that the sad story of life? Those who come after him will not rejoice in him. So it's how empty and how vain it is. Nothing ever gets fixed. Nothing ever gets fixed very often. Things, even promising leaders, don't turn out the way you hope always, often. That crotchety, hard-hearted old king was probably a good guy when he was young. We don't know. Today's today's hero is tomorrow's bum. That's what Ray Stedman says. Today's hero is tomorrow's bum. You see that with, how about that with athletes or rock stars or movie stars or rising young leaders? You think, boy, that guy, that girl has awesome potential. And then wait a while. Where do you find? The end of the story is not always good. So far, so good. Just all kind of... Solomon's just taking a look at life, and he's sort of laughing at life, and he's sort of looking at all the facets of life and all the complexities and all of the foolishness and the vanity of human beings who think so highly of themselves and so preoccupied with success and fame and material things, and how so much of the time people's lives end up being futile and meaningless, and that's because they haven't thought of God. Solomon says in chapter 5, walk prudently. Be careful when you come to the house of God. And draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. They don't know that what they do is evil. Okay, he says, now when you people who do believe in God come to the house of God, be a little bit sensitive to what's going on. What is the house of God? Is this a temple that Solomon built in Jerusalem? No. Nope.
It can be a person.
It's people. We are the house of God here today, right? This is the house of God. We are the house. We're the temple of God. We're the house of God. So he says, when you guys get together as the house of God, when the house of God comes together to meet, then what should you do and not do? Will you come to hear? It says, come to listen rather than blabber, rather than. Get the conversation, take over the conversation, lead it off on a tangent, or be disruptive, or because it is the house of God. Do not be rash with your own mouth, and don't let your heart utter anything hastily before God. Because when the house of God meets, we're all before God, and so God's listening to everything we say, and you can make a total fool out of yourself right here with the house of God, and it would be better to come to learn and listen and to ask good questions and to contribute. Make sense? That's true of church services. Church services can be an utter waste of time because people don't stop to realize that they're coming into the presence of God and that God would like to speak to us and he'd like to meet with us. And so we have it all pre-programmed and planned to go to have it do what we want it to do. We can run the church better than God can. God is in heaven and you are on earth. Let your words be few. A dream comes through much activity. A fool's voice is known by his many words. A dream comes through much activity. There's all kinds of people who've got their own agenda to promote or their own vision or their own idea that they want to sell other people about, their own view of the Bible that they've thought about and worked on and invested in, and they want to convince you that they have got the final answer on things. And there are people that make a fool out of themselves all the time, and so what kind of reputation do they get after a while? Nobody listens to them. Nobody takes you seriously. So then he says, Solomon's interested in our integrity and our character and our reputations and how we treat each other and how we are when we're together. When you make vows to God, do not delay to pay them. God has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. It is better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Now that is a little bit hard to understand in our modern world, but it's still important. What is he talking about?
Make a promise or some agreement to God, and then you break it. Okay. You're gonna make it and keep it, don't break it. You break it, don't make it at all.
It is, yes, that's exactly right. If you make a promise, keep it. or don't make the promise in the first place. Because God takes that very seriously. Don't promise something that you don't intend to do. How about promising something that may be beyond your power to do? How do you do that? I swear to God, I will pay you back the $50 I owe you on Wednesday morning. That's a vow. Wednesday morning comes along, and you say, my drug deal didn't go through. I didn't get the $50. I can't pay you, but I swear I'll have it by Friday. No. I owe you $50. I will do my best to repay it to you when I can. I can't promise when, but I will take this seriously. Here's the note. I'll pay you a little at a time as I can. I'm very embarrassed to be owing you this money and not having a way to pay it back. Now that's not a vow. I'll see you for lunch tomorrow, God willing. I would like to have lunch with you tomorrow. Let's pencil it in. On the other hand, I've got a rather full morning and it might not work out, so I cannot promise to have lunch with you tomorrow. And so now what are some other kinds of vows? One vow would be, we all respect people who honor their commitments, who do what they say. We all respect that. We're always impressed when somebody does exactly what they promised they would do and they do it on time. Now, what other kind of vows are there remember what it's saying here is, if you don't intend to keep a promise, don't make it in the first place. Because God takes vows very, very seriously. What are other examples of vows?
Marriage vows.
Yeah. Who takes marriage vows seriously in a society where the divorce rate is 60%? Those solemn promises that a man and wife take in front of God, in front of the family, in front of everybody, that promises to love, honor, and obey, and sickness and health, and until death do us part, that are solemn vows, that are sacred vows, that I think people mean them when they say them. Do people in love mean them when they say them? But come back in a few years and now they're getting a divorce. And why are they getting a divorce? Well, we're not compatible with each other. Well, we just couldn't get along. Well, we just didn't have anything in common. Well, we decided that we weren't all that good for each other, that we had the right to go on and find somebody that we were better suited for. What do you think about that?
Should have figured it out before
you got married. You should have had somebody sit you down and tell you that this was shotgun wedding, that you're going to stay married, period. Other vows? Our society does not take vows seriously. We don't take promises seriously. We don't take commitments seriously. There's always a contingency. There's always a way out. There's always I really meant to, I'm sorry. I won't do it again. There's always that slipperiness in our vows. And here in Solomon, he's saying, that might be okay with you, but it's not okay with God. So that's what makes these verses so important. When you make a vow to God, this is the thing is, sometimes you used to swear an oath. If you go into a court of law and swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God. When you take an oath in a court, you're bringing the name of God in and you're saying, God, back me up to make sure that I tell the truth. That's a real serious deal. And if you lie in court, that's perjury. If you get out of line in court, it's contempt of court. The courts don't take vows lightly. They take them very seriously. You get yourself in big trouble if you swear to tell the truth and then go in and lie in front of the court. Well, that's one of the places in society where vows are taken seriously. God has no pleasure in fools. If you don't keep your promises, then you're a fool. Pay what you have vowed. And don't make any vows unless you can, unless you're in a position to honor them. And if you're not in a position to honor them, don't make the promise in the first place or qualify it. I hope, I do owe you $50. I'm doing my best to pay it back. I don't know how soon I can pay it back. Hopefully by the end of the month. It depends on whether I get a job or not. Thank you for your generosity. That's not a vow. That's a goodwill, faith, promise, okay? Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? What's that about? James talks about the tongue and how the tongue is so easily gets us in big trouble because we make all kinds of promises and we say all sorts of things that we don't mean, and we're so good at gossiping and slandering and do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. That's kind of related to making promises that you can't keep, or using flattery, or using, or being deceitful. It's easy to be deceitful, to give false impressions, to manipulate people because you want something from them. We got to do that easy. Do not say before the messenger of God that it was an error. That's kind of, there's always a third party in any relationship. God's always there, and He knows whether you're being deceitful, manipulative, gossiping. He always knows what lies behind what you're doing. And we're awfully good at deceiving, manipulating people and circumstances. But God knows, and He's watching after that. I think most of the time we don't always know our motives really well. Why should God be angry at your excuses and destroy the work of your hands? In other words, so that all of your best laid plans come to nothing. All of your manipulating and scheming and wheeling and dealing didn't get you anywhere. You know a little scheming seems like such a clever thing at the time. Just a little shortcut, bending of the rules, and you'll get the job done, and it'll all be done easily and expeditiously. But God's ready to pull the rug out from under you. For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. In the multitude of dreams, all the things that you dream of, that you wish for, that you hope for, all the things that you imagine in life, all of the words and the planning and the discussions can in many cases be empty and lead nowhere. And the conclusion of this is, fear God. Stand in awe and reverence of God. Stand in awe and live your whole life openly and reverently before God. That's the bottom line here. The whole world is like this. The whole world is full of scheming and wheeling and dealing and false promises and striving and ambition and impossible dreams. And you can see right through that. God's watching that. God's keeping score. Fear God. If you see the oppression of the poor and the violent perversion of justice and righteousness in a province, do not marvel at the matter. A high official watches over the high official, and higher officials are over them. Moreover, the profit of the land is for all. The king himself is served from the field. Okay, you notice that the mayor in San Jose is really not that good a guy. He's not very just. He's violent. He oppresses the poor. He doesn't do anything about the homeless. situation. What about the mayor of San Jose? Is there anybody over him? Yeah, there is. God, for one thing. There's always a higher official. There's always somebody accountable. The mayor gets out of line, the governor of the state will call a referendum, or the citizens will, or some civic officials will get involved. The profit of the land is for all. The king himself is served from the field. What's that mean? Well, even the king has to eat. Even the king has to pay his bills. Even the king has to have a place to live. All of the business enterprises of San Jose are for the people, but they're also for the king. The king's just a member of the community. So it does the well-being of the whole community, including the well-being of the king, is part of the whole package. The king may not be doing a very good job, but there's a higher king over him. And in the long run, all the injustice will get fixed. So that means sometimes you've got to live. You live with a bad president or a bad administration. But it's not going to last forever. There is accountability. There's a chain of accountability. God's put government in the world. He's watching over bad guys and over good guys. He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver. He who loves abundance with increase, that is also vanity. Boy, that's pretty heavy. Every time you get a pay raise, your spending goes right on up to eat up the extra income. If somebody gives you a bigger credit line, how long does it take for you to spend up to your new credit line? You get a big fat pay raise, how soon before you spend it all? Our level of consumption rises right up to our level of income all the time. We always, it seems to be human nature to adjust your spending up to your income. No matter how much money you make, that's true of the very rich, it's true of the poor. Everybody, it's like, that's kind of the way life runs. If you have to live on a little, you live on a little, but you generally don't have any left over for saving or giving. If you make a lot of money, do you tend to save more? Not necessarily. Do you tend to be more generous with others? No, not necessarily. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. What profit have the owners except to see them with their eyes? When goods increase, the people increase who eat them. The consumers eat it. When the supply increases, the consumers increase. We need a new shopping mall so we can put all this mass-produced food and clothing and everything in the hands of all these new consumers. So when there's wealth, there's always somebody there to use it up. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of the rich will not permit him to sleep. Once again, he's back to the emptiness of riches. A laboring man, a guy who works at hard physical labor all day long and comes home dead tired and has a shower and goes to bed, will get a great night's sleep, and he may only have a TV dinner. And he's going to get a good night's rest and be rested in the morning. On the other hand, here's this rich man in his big house with a lavish meal, and all night long he tosses and turns and worries and anxiety. Which one is better off? Poor guy's better off. He's had the satisfaction of a job, of his job well done. He doesn't have to worry about losing all his money because he hasn't got any, and he gets a good night's rest, and he feels good about life. And the rich man who's got more than he ever needs is worried about losing it, and he can't sleep at night. There's a lot of humor in Solomon. He's the richest man in the world, remember, by far. There is a severe evil which I've seen under the sun. riches kept for their owner to his hurt. Uh-oh. This is a terrible evil, which I have observed, says Solomon. Riches, which are kept just for their owner's own use, and they end up for his hurt. Miserly living is a very bad thing. To have riches and not use it to benefit others is a very stingy, selfish, bad thing. And there's a lot of, down through history, there's been a lot of rich, miserly Scrooges, or Christmas Scrooge. And he says it's a terrible evil. Severe thing. Those riches perish through misfortune. When this rich man begets a son, there's nothing in his hand. The rich man's son comes into the world without anything. He came from his mother's womb naked, and naked shall he return when he dies, to go as he came, and he'll take nothing from his labor which he can carry away in his own hand. Every single person who ever lived is born into the world stark naked, and you bring nothing with you, and when you leave, you take nothing at all with you, and so you're not, if you're the richest man in the world, you're going to die with nothing. You're going to leave it all behind and go out of this world with nothing. If you're the rich man's son, you're going to come into the world with nothing, get your father's inheritance, but die with nothing. So the meaning of life is not found in the acquisition of riches and wealth and status at all, because you can't take it with you. And its value doesn't last. If you don't use your money now for something useful, it's lost altogether. And you have made yourself a stingy, miserly old person. A lot of people like that. A lot of rich people like that. Also, this is a severe evil, that just exactly as he came, so shall he go. What profit has he who has labored for the wind? Laboring for the wind, that's kind of a joke. Working hard to make a lot of money is like you're trying to capture the wind in your hands and box it up and put it in a package. As if you could, how futile it is to reach out and grab a hold of the wind and hold it. All his days he eats in darkness, and he has much sorrow and sickness and anger. And the biographies of a lot of American rich men are just exactly like this. They're all alone in their old mansion with the servant serving them a meal and no companionship and bitterness and a big old rambling house and they just, nobody visits them, they have no friends, and they die and they have a funeral and that's the end. That's the end of their whole life. Miserable. Much sorrow and sickness and anger. And the doctor, you can't buy your life back with doctors. Conclusion. Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink, and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God has given him. It is his heritage. As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth, and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. He will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. Now, the conclusion. It's a good thing to eat and drink and enjoy life. It's a good thing to enjoy friends. It's a good thing to enjoy all of the wonderful things that God has put into your life and to get pleasure and fulfillment out of them all the time, every day, because that's what God would like to give you. If God gives you riches and wealth, they're not for your own benefit. They are, you can rejoice if you're wealthy because you're in a position to bless and help others and make their, and ease their misery. And that's the gift of God. A person who's caught up in living real life doesn't have time to worry about climbing the ladder of success and competing with his neighbors. The person who enjoys Jesus and is enjoying the Christian life doesn't get sidetracked in the rat race that's going on around you. Isn't that an interesting conclusion that Solomon has? It's good and fitting to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all the labor in which you have toiled under the sun through your whole life, which God has given you. It is your heritage. As to all those people to whom God has given riches and wealth and power to eat and to receive inheritance, this is the gift of God. If God does happen to bless you and prosper you, and he may, then thank God for that and use your wealth to bless other people and to be generous with other people. And the person who's caught up in enjoying God isn't bothered by all this rat race nonsense that he's been talking about. Enjoy Jesus today and enjoy God today, and that's the meaning of life again. See that? Comes around full circle here. Does this all sort of make sense? Does it all fit life from 3,000 years ago from King Solomon? No questions? Our Father, thank you for these powerful, penetrating words from Ecclesiastes. They're things that we need to ponder about and think over and sort of put into contemporary terms. I think it's pretty clear that there's something here for every one of us about the fact that you'd like us to enjoy you, that you take delight in us, that you enjoy talking to us, relating to us, that you're very happy to bless everything that we do. You're happy to take the sadness and sorrow out of our daily lives and to make even mundane things enjoyable. You're happy to give us a song in our hearts and words of thanksgiving and praise, that you're happy to take things that are ordinary and making them meaningful, and to give us good friends and companions, and to allow us the freedom of anxiety and fear, and to not be afraid of tomorrow and not worry about the future, not worry about whether we've got enough or not, that you always take care of us. And we can't control the future, and it's in your hands, and you are a good and kind and benevolent Lord. And it is your heart's desire to bless us in everything we do, and please help us to be open to that and not to shut you out and not to lapse back into the default way of living that everyone around us seems to live all the time. In the name of Jesus. Thanks for coming, gang.
Thank you.
1 hour and 12 minutes. That's longer than any class. Probably broke some law.